than her unwillingness to listen, she had been justified in feeling betrayed. But how to explain? He didn't fully understand why he'd come, even when he tried to put it into words. He could see why she interpreted his actions as those of an obsessed madman. And yes, he was obsessed, just not in the way she imagined. He should have told her about the photograph as soon as he'd arrived, and he struggled to remember why he hadn't done so. Odds were she would have been surprised and asked a few questions, but it would have ended at that. He suspected that Nana would have hired him anyway, and then none of this would have happened. More than anything, he wanted to turn around and go back to her. He wanted to explain, to tell his whole story from the beginning. He wouldn't, though. She needed time alone, or at least time away from him. Time to recover and maybe, just maybe, understand that the Thibaut she'd come to care for was the only Thibaut there was. He wondered whether time alone would bring forgiveness. Thibaut sank in the mud. He noted as a car passed slowly that the water reached its axles. Up ahead, he saw the river stretching across the road. He decided to cut through the woods. Perhaps this would be the last time he would make this walk. Perhaps it was time to return to Colorado. Thibaut moved forward. The summer foliage provided partial cover from the rain, and as he walked deeper into the woods, he felt the distance between them grow with each step he took. Chapter 30. Beth. Freshly showered, Beth was standing in her bedroom in an oversized T-shirt when Nana peeked her head in.
"Do you want to talk about it?"
Nana said. She jerked her thumb toward the window.
"A school called to tell me you were on your way home. The principal seemed a little worried about you, and later I saw you pull up to the office. I figured the two of you were having a spat."
"It's more than a spat, Nana," Beth said, her tone weary.
"That I gathered from the fact that he left, and that you stayed on the porch so long afterwards."
Beth nodded.
"Was it about Ben? He didn't hurt him, did he? Or you?"
"No, nothing like that," Beth said.
"Good, because that's the one thing that can't be fixed."
"I'm not sure this can either." Nana stared out the window before heaving a great sigh.
"I take it I'll have to feed the dogs tonight, huh?"
Beth shot her a look of annoyance.
"Thanks for being so understanding." "Kitty cats and maple trees," she said with a wave of her hand.
Beth thought about it before finally grunting in frustration.
"What does that mean?" "It means nothing, but for a second there, you were too exasperated to feel sorry for yourself."
"You don't understand."
"Try me," she said.
Beth looked up.
"He stalked me, Nana, for 5 years, and then he trekked across the country to search for me. He was obsessed."
Nana was uncharacteristically silent.
"Why don't you start from the beginning?" she suggested,
taking his seat on Beth's bed. Beth wasn't sure she wanted to talk about it, but she figured it was better to get it over with. She began by recounting Keith's visit to her classroom, and over the next 20 minutes, she told Nana about her abrupt departure from school, her agonizing uncertainty, and ended with her confrontation with Logan. When she finished, Nana folded her hands together in her lap.
"So Thibaut admitted he had the picture, and, in your words, babbled about it being a lucky charm, and claimed that he came here because he felt that he owed you something."
Beth nodded.
"Pretty much." "What did he mean by it being a lucky charm?"
"I don't know."
"You didn't ask?"
"I don't care, Nana. The whole thing is creepy and weird.
Who would do something like that?"
Nana's eyebrows knit together.
"I'll admit it sounds strange, but I think I would have wanted to know why he believed it was a lucky charm."
"Why does that matter?"
"Because you weren't there," she emphasized. "You didn't go through the things he did. Maybe he was telling the truth."
Beth winced.
"The picture isn't a lucky charm. That's crazy." "Maybe," Nana responded.
But I've been around long enough to know that strange things happen in war. Soldiers come to believe all sorts of things, and if they think something keeps them safe, what's the harm?
Beth exhaled. It's one thing to believe it. It's entirely different to become obsessed with a photograph and stalk the subject.
Nana put a hand on Beth's knee.
Everyone acts crazy at times. Not like this, Beth insisted. There's something scary about this.
Nana was quiet before letting out a sigh.
You might be right, she shrugged.
Beth studied Nana's face, suddenly overcome with exhaustion.
Will you do me a favor?
What is it?
Will you call the principal and ask him to bring Ben home after school? I don't want you driving in this weather, but I'm not really up to doing it myself.
Chapter 31 Clayton. Clayton tried and failed to negotiate the lake that had formed in front of Beth's house, his boots disappearing into the mud. He stifled the urge to issue a string of profanities. He could see the windows open near the front door, and he knew that Nana would hear him. Despite her age, the woman had the hearing of an owl, and the last thing he wanted to do was make a poor impression. The woman already disliked him enough. He climbed the steps and knocked on the door. He thought he heard someone moving inside, saw Beth's face in the window, and finally watched as the door swung open.
Keith, what are you doing here?
I was worried, he said. I wanted to make sure everything was okay.
It's fine, she said.
Is he still here? Do you want me to talk to him?
No, he's gone. I don't know where he is.
Clayton shuffled his feet, trying to look contrite. I'm sorry about this, and I hate that I had to be the one to tell you. I know you really liked him. Beth nodded, her lips pursed. I also wanted to tell you not to be so hard on yourself. Like I mentioned earlier, people like that, they've learned to hide it. They're sociopaths, and there's no way you could have known. Beth crossed her arms.
I don't want to talk about it.
Clayton held up his hands, knowing he'd pushed too hard, knowing he had to backtrack.
I figured.
And you're right. It's not my place, especially given the crappy way I've treated you in the past. He tucked his thumb into his belt and forced a smile. I just wanted to make sure you were doing okay.
I'm fine, and thanks.
Clayton turned to leave, then stopped. I want you to know that, from what Ben said, Tebow seemed like a nice guy. She looked up in surprise. I just wanted to tell you that, because had it been different, had anything happened to Ben, Tebow would have regretted the day he was born. I would die before I let anything happen to our son, and I know you feel the same way. That's why you're such a great mom. In a life where I've made a ton of mistakes, one of the best things I've done is to let you raise him. She nodded, trying to stop the tears, and turned away. When she swiped at her eyes, Clayton took a step toward her.
Hey, he said, his voice soft. I know you don't want to hear this now, but trust me, you did the right thing. And in time, you're going to find someone, and I'm sure he's going to be the best guy ever. You deserve that.
Her breath hiccuped and Clayton reached out for her. Instinctively, she leaned into him.
It's okay, he whispered.
And for a long moment, they stood on the porch, their bodies close together, as he held her. Clayton didn't stay long. There was no need, he thought. He'd accomplished what he'd set out to do. Beth now saw him as the kind, caring, and compassionate friend. Someone who'd atone for his sins. The hug was just the icing on the cake. Nothing he'd planned, but a nice conclusion to their encounter. He wouldn't press her. That would be a mistake. She needed some time to get over Thibault. Even if he was a sociopath, even if the guy left town, feelings aren't turned on and off like a switch. But they would pass as surely as the rain would continue to fall. Next step? to make sure that Thibault was on his way back to Colorado. And then, be the nice guy. Maybe invite Beth over while he and Ben were doing something. Ask her to stay for a barbecue. Keep it casual at first, so she didn't suspect anything. And then suggest doing something with Ben on another night of the week. It was essential that he keep the whole thing far from Nana's prying eyes, which meant staying away from here. Though he knew Beth wouldn't be thinking straight for at least a few weeks, Nana would be, and the last thing he wanted was for Nana to get in Beth's ear about what he was likely up to. After that, as they got used to each other again, maybe they'd have a few beers together while Ben was sacked out. Sort of a spur-of-the-moment thing. Maybe spike her beer with a bit of vodka, so she couldn't drive home. Then offer to let her sleep in the bed while he took the couch. Be the perfect gentleman, but keep the beer flowing. Talk about the old times, the good ones, and let her cry about Thibault. Let the emotions flow, and see what happened. He smiled as he started the car, thinking a friends-with-benefits arrangement was looking more promising with every passing minute. Chapter 32 Beth Beth didn't sleep well and woke up exhausted. The storm had hit in full fury last night, bringing heavy winds and massive amounts of rain, dwarfing the previous deluge. The day before, she couldn't have imagined the water getting any deeper, but when she looked out the window, the office looked like an isolated island in the midst of the ocean. Last night, she pulled her car onto a spit of higher land near the magnolia tree. Good thing, she realized now. It, too, was its own little island while the water nearly reached the high floorboards of Nana's truck. The truck had always managed well in floods, but it was a good thing that the brakes had been fixed. Otherwise, they would have been stranded. Last night, she'd taken it into town to buy a gallon of milk and a few other basic necessities, but the trip had been pointless. Everything was closed. And the only other vehicles that she'd seen on the road were utility trucks and SUVs driven by the sheriff's department. Half the town was without power, but so far their house was unaffected. If there was one bright spot, it was the TV and radio reports predicted the last of the storms would roll through today. Tomorrow, hopefully, the water would begin to recede. She sat in the porch swing outside while Nana and Ben were playing gin rummy at the kitchen table. It was the one game in which they were equally matched, and it kept Ben from getting bored. Later, she figured she'd let him splash around in the front yard while she went to check on the dogs. She'd probably give up any attempt to keep him dry and simply let him wear his swimsuit. When she'd gone out earlier in the morning to feed the dogs, her raincoat had been useless. Listening to the sound of the rain drumming steadily on the roof, she found her thoughts drifting to Drake. She wished for the thousandth time that she could talk to him, and wondered what he would have said about the photograph. Had he, too, believed in its power? Drake had never been particularly superstitious, but her heart lurched every time she recalled his inexplicable panic at the loss of the photo. Nana was right. She didn't know what Drake had experienced over there, and she didn't know what Logan had either. As informed as she tried to be, none of it felt real to her. She wondered about the stress they felt thousands of miles from home, wearing flak jackets, living among people who spoke a foreign language, trying to stay alive. Was it impossible to believe that anyone would latch on to something he believed would keep him safe? No, she decided. It was no different from carrying a St. Christopher medal or a rabbit's foot. It didn't matter that there was nothing logical about it. Logic didn't matter. Nor did an absolute belief in magic powers. If it made someone feel safer, it simply did. But tracking her down? Stalking her? That's where her understanding broke down. As skeptical as she was about Keith's intentions, or even his attempt to appear genuinely concerned for her well-being, she had to admit that the situation made her feel acutely vulnerable. What had Logan said? Something about owing her? For his life, she assumed. But how? She shook her head. drained by the thoughts chasing endlessly through her mind. She looked up when she heard the door creak open.
Hey, Mom?
Yes, sweetie.
Ben came over and took a seat beside her.
Where's Tebow? I haven't seen him yet.
He's not coming in, she said.
Because of the storm?
She hadn't told him yet, nor was she ready to.
He had some things to do, she improvised.
Okay,
Ben said. He looked out into the yard.
You can't even see the grass anymore.
I know, but the rain's supposed to stop soon.
Has it ever been like this before, when you were little?
A couple of times, but always with a hurricane. He nodded before pushing his glasses up. She ran a hand through his hair.
I heard Logan gave you something.
I'm not supposed to talk about it,
he said, his voice serious.
It's a secret.
You can tell your mom. I'm good at keeping secrets.
Nice try,
he teased.
I'm not falling for that one.
She smiled and leaned back, pushing the swing into motion with her feet.
That's okay. I already know about the picture.
Ben looked over at her, wondering how much she knew.
You know, she went on, for protection?
His shoulders slumped.
He told you?
Of course. Oh, he said, his disappointment evident.
He told me to keep it between the two of us. Do you have it? I'd like to see it if you do.
Ben hesitated before reaching into his pocket. He pulled out a folded snapshot and handed it over. Beth opened the photo and stared, feeling a surge of memories overtake her. Her last weekend with Drake and the conversation they'd had. The sight of the Ferris wheel, the shooting star.
Did he say anything else when he gave it to you?
She asked.
Aside from it being a secret, I mean.
He said his friend Victor called it a lucky charm and that it kept him safe in Iraq.
She felt her pulse pick up tempo, and she brought her face close to Ben's.
Did you say Victor called it a lucky charm?
Uh-huh,
Ben nodded.
That's what he said.
Are you sure?
Of course I'm sure.
Beth stared at her son, feeling at war with herself. Chapter 33 Tebow. Tebow loaded his backpack with the few provisions he had in the house. The wind was gusting and the rain still coming down hard, but he'd walked through worse weather before. Still, he couldn't seem to summon the energy he needed to walk out the door. It had been one thing to walk here. It was different to walk away. He was different. He'd left Colorado feeling more alone than he'd ever felt before. Here, his life seemed full and complete, or it had until yesterday. Zeus was finally settled in the corner. He'd spent most of the day pacing, restless because Tebow hadn't taken him for his walk. Every time Tebow got up to get a glass of water, Zeus scrambled to his feet, anxious to know if it was time to go. It was mid-afternoon, but the cloudy, rainy sky made it darker. The storm continued to lash the house, but he sensed it was in its dying stages, like a recently caught fish flopping on the dock. It wasn't going to go quietly. He spent most of the day trying not to think about what had happened, or how it all could have been avoided. That was a fool's game. He had messed it up, simple as that, and the past couldn't be undone. He'd always tried to live his life without dwelling on things that couldn't be undone, but this was different. He wasn't sure he'd ever get over it. At the same time, he couldn't shake the feeling that it wasn't over yet, that something remained unfinished. Was it simply closure that he was missing? No, it was more than that. His wartime experience had taught him to trust his instincts, even though he'd never been sure where they'd come from. Inasmuch as he knew he should leave Hampton, if only to get as far away from Keith Clayton as possible, he was under no illusions that Clayton would forgive and forget. He couldn't bring himself to walk out the door. Clayton was the center of the wheel. Clayton, and Ben and Elizabeth, was the reason he had come. He just couldn't figure out why or what he was supposed to do.
In the corner, Zeus rose to his feet and headed toward the window. Tebow turned toward him just as he heard a knock at the door. Instinctively, he tensed, but when Zeus peeked through the glass, his tail started to wag. When Tebow opened the door, he saw Elizabeth standing before him. He froze. For a moment, they simply stared at each other.
"Hi, Logan," she finally said.
"Hello, Elizabeth." A tentative smile, so quick as to be almost non-existent, flashed across her features. He wondered whether he'd imagined it.
"May I come in?"
Tebow stepped aside, studying her as she removed her slicker, her blonde hair spilling out of the hood. She held it out uncertainly until Tebow took it from her. He hung it on the front doorknob before facing her.
"I'm glad you came," he said.
She nodded. Zeus nosed her hand and she stroked him behind the ears before turning her attention to Tebow again.
"Can we talk?" she said.
"If you'd like." He motioned to the couch and Elizabeth took a seat at one end. He took a seat on the other.
"Why did you give the photo to Ben?"
she asked without preamble. Tebow studied the far wall, trying to figure out how to explain himself without making things even worse. Where to begin?
"Tell me in 10 words or less," she suggested, sensing his reticence. "Then we'll go from there."
Tebow massaged his forehead with one hand before sighing, his eyes moving toward her. "Because I thought it would keep him safe."
"Safe?"
"Out at the treehouse. The storm has weakened the whole structure, including the bridge. He shouldn't go there again. It's on the verge of collapse." Her gaze was intense and unblinking.
"Why didn't you keep it?"
"Because I felt like he needed it more than me."
"Because it would keep him safe."
Tebow nodded. "Yes." She fiddled with the couch cover before turning toward him again.
"So you honestly believe what you said about the photo being a lucky charm?"
Zeus walked toward him and lay at his feet. "Maybe," Tebow said. She leaned forward.
"Why don't you tell me the whole story?"
Tebow gazed at the floor, resting his elbows on his knees, and began, hesitantly, to tell her the whole saga of the photograph. He started with the poker games in Kuwait, then moved on to the RPG that knocked him unconscious and the firefight in Fallujah. He detailed the car bombs and the IEDs he'd survived in Ramadi, including the one in which Victor claimed that the photograph had saved both their lives. He talked about the reaction of his fellow Marines and the legacy of their distrust. He paused before meeting her eyes. "But even after all that, I still didn't believe it. But Victor did. He always had. He believed in that kind of stuff, and I humored him because it was important to him. But I never believed it. At least, not consciously." He clasped his hands together, his voice becoming softer. "On our last weekend together, Victor told me that I owed a debt to the woman in the photo, because the photo had kept me safe, that otherwise there was no balance. It was my destiny to find her," he said. "A few minutes later, Victor was dead, but I escaped unharmed. Even then, I didn't believe it. But then, I began to see his ghost." In a halting voice, he told her about those encounters. Reluctant to meet her gaze for fear of seeing utter disbelief there. In the end, he shook his head and sighed. "After that, the rest is just like I told you. I was messed up, so I took off. Yes, I went to find you. But not because I'd been obsessed with you. Not because I loved you or wanted you to love me. I did it because Victor said it was my destiny, and I kept seeing his ghost. I didn't know what to expect when I got here. And then, somewhere along the way, it became a challenge. Whether I could find you, how long it would take me. When I finally arrived at the kennel and saw the help wanted sign, I guess I thought that would be a way to repay the debt. Applying for the job felt like the right thing to do. Just like when Ben and I were in the treehouse, Giving the photo to him felt like the right thing to do. But I'm not sure I could explain those things, even if I tried.
You gave Ben the photo to keep him safe,
Elizabeth repeated. As crazy as it sounds, yes. She digested this in silence. Then,
why didn't you tell me from the beginning?
I should have, he said. The only thing I can think is that I carried the photo with me for 5 years, and I didn't want to give it up until I understood its purpose.
Do you think you understand it now?
He leaned over to pet Zeus before answering. He looked directly at her. I'm not sure. What I can say is that what happened between us, everything that happened, didn't start when I found the photo. It started when I walked into the kennel. That was when you first became real to me, and the more I got to know you, the more real I felt, happier and alive in a way I hadn't felt in a long, long time, like you and I were meant to be.
Your destiny?
She lifted an eyebrow. No, not like that. It has nothing to do with the photo, or the journey here, or anything Victor said. It's just that I've never met anyone like you before, and I'm certain I never will again. I love you, Elizabeth. And more than that, I like you. I enjoy spending time with you. She scrutinized him, her expression unreadable. When she spoke, her voice was matter-of-fact. You realize that it's still a crazy story that makes you sound like an obsessive nut job.
I know, Thibault agreed. Believe me, I feel like a freak even to myself.
What if I told you to leave Hampton and never contact me again?
Elizabeth probed. Then I'd leave, and you'd never hear from me again. The comment hung in the air, pregnant with meaning. She shifted on the couch, turning away in apparent disgust before swiveling her face back toward him.
You wouldn't even call? After all we've been through,
she sniffed.
I can't believe that.
Relief swept through him when he realized she was teasing. He exhaled, unaware that he had been holding his breath, and grinned. If that's what it took for you to believe I'm not a psycho.
I think that's pathetic. A guy should at least call.
He scooted imperceptibly closer on the couch. I'll keep that in mind.
You do realize that you're not going to be able to tell this story if you intend to live around here.
He slid even closer, noticeably this time. I can live with that.
And if you expect a raise just because you're dating the boss's granddaughter, you can forget that too.
I'll make do.
I don't know how. You don't even have a car.
By then, he had sidled up next to her, and she'd turned back to him, her hair just brushing his shoulder. He leaned in and kissed her neck.
I'll figure something out, he whispered, before pressing his lips to hers.
They kissed on the couch for a long time. When he finally carried her to the bedroom, they made love, their bodies together as one. Their exchange was passionate and angry and forgiving, as raw and tender as their emotions. Afterward, Thibault lay on his side, gazing at Elizabeth. He brushed her cheek with his finger, and she kissed it.
I guess you can stay,
she whispered. Chapter 34 Clayton. Clayton stared at the house in disbelief, his knuckles white on the steering wheel. He blinked repeatedly to clear his vision, but he still saw the same things. Beth's car in the driveway, the couple kissing on the couch, Thibault leading her to the bedroom. Beth and Thibault together. With every passing minute, he felt stronger waves of anger cresting and crashing inside him. His perfect plans, all of them, up in smoke. And Thibault would forever have him over a barrel. He pressed his lips together in a tight line. He was tempted to storm in on them, but then there was the damn dog, again. It had been hard enough already, following them through his binoculars from his car without being noticed. Thibault, the dog, Beth. He banged the steering wheel. How could this have happened? Hadn't Beth heard what he'd said? Didn't she understand how much danger she was in? Didn't she care about Ben? No way was that psycho going to be a part of his son's life. Not a chance. Not on his life. He should have expected this. He should have known how stupid Beth would be. She might be pushing 30, but she had the intelligence of a child. He should have known that she'd see in Thibault whatever she wanted to see and ignore the obvious. It would come to an end, though, sooner rather than later. He'd make her see the light, no matter what it took. Chapter 35. Thibault. After kissing Elizabeth goodbye at the door, Thibault collapsed on the sofa, feeling both drained and relieved. He reveled in the knowledge that Elizabeth had forgiven him, that she'd tried to understand and make sense of the convoluted journey he'd taken to get here seemed nothing short of miraculous. She accepted him, warts and all, something he'd never thought possible. Before she left, she'd invited him for dinner, and though he'd readily agreed, he planned to rest up before he went. He somehow doubted that he'd have the energy for conversation otherwise. Before his nap, he knew he needed to take Zeus out, at least for a little while. He went to the back porch and retrieved his rain suit. Zeus followed him outside, watching him with interest. "Yeah, we're going out," he said. "Just let me get dressed first." Zeus barked and leapt with excitement, like a prancing deer. He raced to the door and back to Thibault again. "I'm going as fast as I can. Relax." Zeus continued to circle and prance around him. "Relax," he said again. Zeus fixed him with a beseeching gaze before reluctantly sitting. Thibault donned the rain suit and a pair of boots, then pushed open the screen door. Zeus bounded out into the rain, immediately sinking into the muddy ground. Unlike Nana's place, his property occupied a slight rise. The water collected a quarter mile away. Up ahead, Zeus veered toward the forest, then back to the open area again, then circled around to the gravel driveway, running and bounding in sheer joy. Thibault smiled, thinking, "I know exactly how you feel." They spent a few minutes outside, wandering in the storm. The sky had turned charcoal, heavy with rain-burdened clouds. The wind had picked up again, and Thibault could feel the water stinging his face as it blew sideways. It didn't matter. For the first time in years, he felt truly free. At the base of the driveway, he noted that Elizabeth's tire tracks had nearly washed away. In a few more minutes, the rain would smooth them away completely. Something snagged his attention, though, and he tried to make sense of what he was seeing. His first thought was that the tires that had left the track seemed too wide. He walked over for a closer look, reasoning that the set of tracks she'd left going out had probably overlapped the set coming in. It was only when he stood at the edge of the drive that he realized he'd been mistaken. There were two sets of tracks, both leading in and out. Two vehicles. At first, it didn't make sense. His mind began to click quickly as the puzzle pieces slid into place. Someone else had been here. That didn't make sense, unless... He glanced toward the path that led through the forest to the kennel. At that moment, the wind and rain unleashed in full fury, and he squinted before his breath caught in his throat. All at once, he took off at a run, making sure to pace himself. His mind raced as he ran, calculating how long it would take to get there. He hoped he would make it in time. Chapter 36. Beth. As fate would have it, Nana was in the kennel office when Keith stormed into the house and closed the door behind him, acting as if he owned the place. Even from the kitchen, Beth could see the veins on his neck protruding. His hands balled into fists when his eyes locked on hers. When he marched through the living room, Beth felt something give way inside her. Fear filled its place. Never once had she seen him like this, and she backed away, following the angles of the cabinets. Keith surprised her by stopping at the entrance to the kitchen. He smiled, but his expression was off somehow, a grotesque and demented caricature of what it was supposed to be. "Sorry for barging in like this," he said with exaggerated courtesy, "but we need to talk."
"What are you doing here? You can't just walk in here."
"Cooking dinner, huh?" he said. "I remember when you used to cook dinner for me."
"Get out, Keith," she said, her voice hoarse.
"I'm not going anywhere," he said, looking at her as if she didn't know what she was talking about. He motioned toward the chair.
"Why don't you sit down?"
"I don't want to sit down," she whispered, hating how frightened she sounded. "I want you to leave."
"That's not going to happen," he said.
He smiled again, but it was no better than his first attempt. There was a vacancy in his gaze that she'd never seen before. She felt her heartbeat speed up.
"Would you get me a beer, please?" he asked. "It's been a long day at the office, if you know what I mean."
She swallowed, afraid to look away.
"I don't have any more."
He nodded, glancing around the kitchen, before fixing his gaze on her again. He pointed.
"I see one right there, by the stove. There's got to be another one somewhere. You mind if I check the fridge?"
He didn't wait for an answer. He walked to the fridge and opened it before reaching for the bottom shelf. He came out with a bottle.
"Found one," he crowed.
He looked at her as he opened it.
"Guess you were mistaken, huh?"
He took a long pull and winked. She forced herself to stay calm.
"What do you want, Keith?"
"Oh, you know, just wanted to catch up, see if there's anything I should know."
"Know about what?"
she asked, her stomach clenching.
"About Thibault," he said.
She ignored the mangling of the name.
"I don't know what you're talking about."
He took another drink, swishing the beer in his mouth as he nodded. He swallowed, the sound loud.
"Driving over here, that's what I thought you might say," he said, sounding almost conversational. "But I know you better than you think I do."
He gestured at her with his beer bottle.
"There was a time there when I wasn't sure I knew you at all, but that's changed in the past few years. Raising a son together really bonds a couple, don't you think?"
She didn't respond.
"That's why I'm here, you know, because of Ben. Because I want the best for him, and right now, I'm not sure you're thinking all that clearly about things."
He took a deliberate step toward her and took another long pull of his beer. The bottle was already nearly empty. He wiped his mouth with the back of his hand before going on.
"See, I've been thinking that you and I haven't always had the best relationship. That's not good for Ben. He needs to know that we still get along, that we're still close friends. Don't you think that's an important lesson to teach him? That even if your parents get divorced, they can still be friends."
She didn't like the sound of his rambling monologue, but she was afraid to cut him off. This was a different Keith Clayton, a dangerous one.
"I think it's important," he continued.
He took another step toward her.
"In fact, I can't think of anything more important."
"Just stay back," she said.
"I don't think so," he scolded her. "You haven't been thinking all that clearly in the last couple of days."
As he neared, she slid farther down the bank of counters, trying to keep him in front of her.
"Don't come any closer. I'm warning you."
He kept closing the distance, staring at her with those vacant eyes.
"See what I mean? You're acting like you think I'm going to hurt you. I'd never, ever hurt you. You should know that about me."
"You're crazy."
"No, I'm not. A little angry, maybe, but not crazy."
When he smiled again, the vacancy in his eyes vanished,
and her stomach did a flip-flop. He went on, "Do you know that even after all you've put me through, I still think you're beautiful?" She didn't like where this was going. Not at all. By then, she'd reached the corner with no place left to go.
"Just leave, okay? Ben's upstairs, and Nana will be back in a minute."
"All I want is a kiss. Is that such a big deal?" She wasn't sure she'd heard him right.
"A kiss?" she parroted.
"For now," he said. "That's all. Just for old time's sake. Then I'll go. I'll walk right out of here. I promise."
"I'm not going to kiss you," she said, stunned.
By then, he was standing before her. "You will," he said, "and you'll do more later. But for now, a kiss is fine." She arched her back, trying to keep away.
"Please, Keith, I don't want this. I don't want to kiss you."
"You'll get over it," he said. When he leaned in, she turned away. He took hold of her upper arms as he moved his lips toward her ear. Beth could feel her heart begin to hammer.
"You're hurting me," she gasped.
"Here's the thing, Beth," he whispered. She could feel the warmth of his breath on her neck. "If you don't want to kiss me, that's fine. I'll accept that. But I've decided that I want to be a little more than friends."
"Get out,"
she hissed, and with a laugh, Keith let her go.
"Sure," he said. He took a step back. "No problem, I'll leave. But I should let you know what's going to happen if we don't work something out."
"Just leave," she shouted.
"I think we should go on a date every now and then. And I'm not going to take no for an answer."
The way he said date made her skin crawl. Beth couldn't believe what she was hearing.
"After all, I warned you about Thibault," he added. "But where were you today?"
"At his place." He shook his head. "That was a big mistake. You see, it's pretty easy for me to make a case that he stalked you and that he's obsessive. Both of those things make him dangerous, but you're obviously ignoring it. And that makes it dangerous for Ben to be forced to live with you." His expression was neutral. Beth was paralyzed by his words.
"I'd hate to have to go to the courts and tell them what you're doing, but I will, and I'm sure they'll grant me full custody this time."
"You wouldn't," she whispered.
"I will, unless..."
His obvious enjoyment as he spoke made it that much more horrifying. He paused, letting it sink in, before speaking like a professor again.
"Let me make sure you understand. First, you tell Thibault that you never want to see him again. Then you tell him to leave town. After that, we'll go out, for old time's sake." "It's either that, or Ben's going to live with me."
"I'm not going to live with you,"
a small voice shouted from the kitchen doorway. Beth looked past Keith to see Ben, his expression horrified. Ben started to back away.
"I'm not going to do it."
Ben turned and ran, slamming the front door behind him as he raced into the storm. Chapter 37 Clayton. Beth tried to force her way past Clayton, but he reached for her arm again.
"We're not done yet," he growled.
He wasn't going to let her leave without making sure she understood.
"He ran outside."
"He'll be fine. I want to make sure you're clear on how things are going to go with us."
Beth didn't hesitate, slapping him across the face with her free hand, and he recoiled. When he let go, she pushed him backward with all her might, sensing that he was still off balance.
"Get the hell out," she screamed.
As soon as he steadied his feet, she slammed him in the chest again.
"I'm so sick of you and your family telling me what I can and can't do, and I'm not going to put up with it anymore."
"Too bad," he shot back, the words coming naturally. "You don't have a choice. I'm not going to let Ben anywhere near that boyfriend of yours."
Instead of answering, as if tired of listening to him, she pushed away and strode past him.
"Where are you going?" he demanded. "We're not finished."
She pounded through the living room.
"I'm going to find Ben."
"It's just rain."
"It's flooding, in case you haven't noticed."
He watched her run out onto the porch, expecting her to find Ben there, but for some reason, she looked both ways and vanished from view. Lightning flashed, thunder echoing a moment later. Close. Too close. Clayton moved to the door and noticed that she'd headed to the far edge and was scanning the yard. Just then, he saw Nana approaching with an umbrella.
"Have you seen Ben?"
Beth suddenly called out.
"No,"
Nana answered, looking confused, rain pouring around her.
"I just got here. What's going on?"
She stopped short at the sight of Clayton.
"What's he doing here?"
she demanded.
"He didn't go past you?"
Beth asked, suddenly jogging toward the steps.
"It's no big deal,"
Clayton said, knowing he had to finish things with Beth.
"He'll be back."
Beth stopped suddenly and faced him. All at once, Clayton noticed her anger had been replaced by something close to terror. The noise of the storm seemed to be suddenly very far away.
"What is it?" he asked.
"The treehouse."
It took only a moment to process the words, and then Clayton felt his chest constrict. A moment later, they were both charging for the woods. Chapter 38 Tebow, Beth, and Clayton. Tebow finally arrived at the kennel driveway, his boots waterlogged and heavy. Zeus kept pace alongside him, slowed only by the knee-deep water. Up ahead, he could see the car and the truck, as well as another SUV. As he approached, he made out the lights on top and knew that Clayton was at the house. Despite his exhaustion, he surged forward, splashing hard. Zeus was bounding through the water like a dolphin skimming over the waves. The harder Tebow ran, the farther the distance seemed. But finally he passed the kennel office and angled toward the house. Only then did he notice Nana standing on the porch, aiming a flashlight toward the forest. Even from a distance, he looked panicked.
"Nana!"
he called out, but the storm kept the sound of his voice from reaching her. A few moments later, she must have heard him, for she turned in his direction, catching him in the glare of her flashlight.
"Tebow?"
Tebow forced his way through the last few steps. The rain whipped around them and the waning light made it difficult to see. He slowed to a walk, trying to catch his breath.
"What happened?"
he shouted.
"Ben's gone,"
she shouted back.
"What do you mean, gone? What happened?"
"I don't know,"
Nana cried.
"Clayton was here, and Beth came out looking for Ben, and then the two of them took off toward the creek. I heard something about the treehouse."
A moment later, Tebow was sprinting toward the woods, Zeus at his side. The rain and wind lashed the branches on either side of them, cutting their faces and hands. The path had been blocked by dozens of fallen limbs, forcing Beth and Keith to push through bushes and vines to get around them. Twice Beth stumbled and fell. Behind her, she heard Keith fall as well. The mud was thick and viscous. Halfway to the treehouse, Beth's shoe came off, but she didn't stop. The treehouse, the bridge, the flood. Only adrenaline and fear kept her from throwing up. In her mind's eye, she could see her son on the bridge as it suddenly gave way. In the shadows, she stumbled again over a half-decayed tree trunk and felt a searing pain in her foot. She rose as quickly as she could, trying to ignore it. But as soon as she put weight on it, she crumpled to the ground again. By then, Keith had reached her side, and he pulled her up without a word. Keeping an arm around her waist, he dragged her forward. They both knew Ben was in danger. Clayton had to force himself not to succumb to panic. He told himself that Ben was intelligent, that Ben would know danger when he saw it, that he wouldn't press his luck. Ben wasn't the bravest kid. For the first and only time in his life, he was grateful for that. Even as they struggled through the underbrush, Beth hobbling beside him, Clayton couldn't ignore what he was seeing. Far beyond its banks, almost at their feet, he saw the creek,
running wider, stronger, and faster than he'd ever seen it. Thibaut had been running hard, charging through mud and water, forcing himself not to slow, but finding it more difficult with every step to keep up his desperate pace. Branches and vines snapped at his face and arms, scissoring him with cuts he didn't feel as he blasted through them. As he ran, he ripped off his raincoat, and then his shirt. Almost there, he kept telling himself, only a little bit farther. And in the farthest reaches of his mind, he heard the echo of Victor's voice. There is more. Beth could feel the bones in her foot grinding against one another with every step, sending flashes of fire throughout her lower body, but she refused to scream or cry out. As they drew near the treehouse, the creek widened even more, the current curling and whipping into circles. Brackish water broke into tiny waves around heaps of fallen branches along the fast-disappearing banks. The turbulent water was filled with debris, enough to knock anyone unconscious. Rain came down from the sky in sheets. The wind toppled another branch, and it came crashing down only yards away. The mud seemed to suck the energy from both of them. But she knew they'd reached the oak tree. Through the downpour, she could make out the rope bridge, like the ragged mast of a ship finally sighted through a misty harbor. Her eyes swung from the ladder to the rope bridge, toward the central landing. The waters of the creek were racing over it, debris collecting against it. Her gaze traveled from the rope bridge to the treehouse platform, taking in the awkward angle of the dangling bridge. It hovered only a foot above the water because the platform had nearly been ripped off the treehouse's ancient structural support, clearly about to give way. As if in a waking nightmare, she suddenly spotted Ben in the rushing creek, clinging to the rope bridge below the treehouse platform. Only then did she allow herself to scream. Clayton felt fear flood his veins as soon as he saw Ben grasping the fraying edge of the rope bridge. His mind raced frantically. Too far to swim to the other side, and no time. "Stay here!" he shouted to Beth as he raced toward the tree ladder. He scaled it and set off on the bridge at a run, desperate to reach Ben. He could see the treehouse platform sinking. Once the force of the current touched it, it would tear away completely. On his third step, the dry, rotted planks broke, and Clayton felt himself smash through the platform, breaking his ribs on the way, and free-falling toward the water. It was all he could do to grab the rope as he hit the raging water. He struggled to tighten his grip as he went under, his clothes dragging him down. He felt the current pulling at him and the rope tightened. He held on, trying to get his head above water, kicking wildly. He bobbed to the surface and gasped. His broken ribs exploded in pain, making everything go black for an instant. In a panic, he reached for the rope with the other hand, fighting against the current. As he held on, ignoring the pain, branches rammed his body before spinning off wildly. The current crashed over his face, obscuring his vision, making it difficult to breathe, making it difficult to think of anything but survival. In his struggle, he didn't notice the pilings beneath the central landing lurch under the strain of his weight, beginning to lean with the ferocious current. Beth hobbled to her feet and tried to walk. She got three steps before falling again. She cupped her mouth and shouted across the creek,
"Move along the rope, Ben! Move away from the platform! You can do it!"
She wasn't sure whether he heard her. But a moment later, she saw him start to inch out from beneath the platform toward the harsher current in the center of the creek, toward his father. Keith was floundering, barely holding on. Everything seemed to speed up and slow down at exactly the same time, when she suddenly saw movement in the distance, a little ways upstream. From the corner of her eye, she spotted Logan ripping off his boots and rain bottoms. A moment later, he dove into the water, Zeus close behind him. Clayton knew he couldn't hold on much longer. The pain from his ribs was excruciating, and the current continued to beat him down. He could catch his breath only in snatches, and he flailed against the death,
he suddenly knew was coming. The relentless current was moving Tebow 2 feet down the creek for every foot he was moving across. He knew he could backtrack on land once he reached the opposite bank, but he didn't have that much time. Focusing his sights on Ben, he kicked with everything he had. A large branch slammed into him, sending him under for a moment. When he surfaced again, disoriented, he saw Zeus behind him, paddling hard. He regained his bearings, then stroked and kicked with desperate effort. In despair, he saw that he hadn't even reached the center of the creek. Beth saw Ben inching farther along the fraying rope bridge, and she dragged herself closer to the water's edge. "Come on!" she shouted, sobbing now. "You can do it! Hold on, baby!" In mid-stroke, Tebow collided with the submerged central landing of the bridge. He rolled in the water, spinning out of control. A moment later, he smashed into Clayton. Panicking, Clayton grabbed for his arm with his free hand, dragging Tebow under. Tebow flailed and felt for the rope, his grip tightening just as Clayton let go. Clayton clung instead to Tebow, clambering on top of him in a frenzied attempt to reach the air. Tebow struggled underwater, holding the rope with one hand, unable to free himself from Clayton. His lungs felt as if they would explode, panic beginning to overtake him. At that very moment, the pilings lurched again. The downstream weight of Clayton and Tebow was too much to hold, and with a tearing sound, the landing gave way completely. Beth watched Keith and Logan struggle just before the remaining ropes attached to the central landing snapped. Across the creek, the treehouse platform tumbled into the creek in a massive eruption of water, and Ben was whipsawed downstream. In horror, Beth saw that he was still clinging to the rope attached to the central landing, which had spiraled into the current. Zeus had been getting close to Logan and Keith when the central landing suddenly heaved like a seashell, rolled up by the waves, and crashed. Zeus vanished from sight. It was all happening too fast. She could no longer see Logan or Keith, and only after frantically scanning the water did she spot Ben's head, a speck among the debris. She heard Ben's high-pitched cries and saw him fighting to keep his head above water. She rose again and hobbled forward, immune to the pain, trying desperately to keep him in view. And then, like a dream come to life, she saw a dark, sleek head moving purposefully toward her son. Zeus. She heard Ben calling for the dog, and her heart suddenly filled. She hobbled and fell, rose again, and scrambled forward, then fell once more. At last she began to crawl, trying to see what was happening. She used the branches to drag herself forward. Zeus and Ben were getting smaller as they were carried downstream, but Zeus was getting ever closer. Then, all at once, their two figures merged, and Zeus suddenly turned, heading for her side of the creek, Ben behind him, holding Zeus's tail.
"Kick, baby! Kick!"
she screamed. She hobbled and hopped and thrashed her way forward, trying and failing to keep up with the current. Ben and Zeus were getting farther away with every passing second. She strained to keep sight of them. They'd reached the center of the creek. No, past the center. She kept going, fighting with every remaining shred of strength to keep them in sight, pushing forward, instinct taking over. Instead of pain, she felt her heart beating with every step. Only a third of the way to the edge of the water, the current getting slower, now a quarter. She kept going, clawing at branches and pulling herself forward. They were lost in the foliage, and it took a few agonizing moments, but she found them again. Almost there, allowing the relief to seep in. Only a little bit farther. Please, God, just a little more. Then they were there. Ben's feet hit first and he let go. Zeus surged forward and then reached ground as well. Beth lunged toward them as both Zeus and Ben staggered from the water. Zeus collapsed as soon as he hit dry land. Ben crumpled a moment later. By the time Beth reached them, Zeus was on his feet, his legs trembling from exhaustion, drenched and coughing. Beth went to the ground beside her son and sat him up as he began to cough in time with Zeus.
"Are you okay?" she cried.
"I'm okay,"
he panted. He coughed again and wiped the water from his face.
"I was scared, but I had the picture in my pocket. Thibaut said it would keep me safe."
He swiped at his nose.
"Where's Dad? And Thibaut?"
At his words, they both began to cry. Epilogue. 2 months later. Beth glanced in the rearview mirror and smiled at the sight of Zeus standing in the bed of the truck, his nose to the wind. Ben sat beside her, rangier since his recent growth spurt, but still not quite tall enough to rest his elbow comfortably out the window. It was the first warm spell they'd had after weeks of miserably cold weather, and Christmas was coming soon. Less than a couple of weeks away, the heat and storms of October had already become a distant memory. The floods had made national news. Downtown Hampton had flooded like many other towns in the region. In all, 6 people had lost their lives. Despite the nightmare they had all endured, Beth realized that she felt a kind of peace for the first time in recent memory. Since the funeral, she'd grappled with the extraordinary events that had led to that fateful day. She knew that many people in town wondered about the choices she'd made. Occasionally, she heard whispers, but for the most part, she ignored them. If Logan had taught her anything, it was that sometimes her faith in herself and her instincts was all she had. Thankfully, Nana had continued to improve in the days and weeks after the accident, as she referred to it. Beth, and especially Ben, had leaned on her for her special brand of wisdom and her unfaltering support. These days, she sang regularly with a choir, found time to train the dogs, and was using both hands, limping only occasionally when tired. There had actually been a couple of weeks back when both of them were walking exactly the same way. It was 2 days after Beth had had her cast removed. She'd broken 4 bones in her foot and had been in a cast for 5 weeks, and Nana had ribbed her about it, enjoying the idea of someone else being the invalid. Ben had changed markedly since then, in some ways that Beth worried about, and in others that made her proud. Surviving the ordeal had given Ben a newfound confidence that he carried with him to school, or at least she liked to think so. Sometimes she wondered whether it was because of the photo he'd carried in his pocket. The lamination was scuffed and worn and beginning to separate, but he wouldn't part with it, carrying it with him everywhere. In time, she assumed he'd grow out of it, but who knew? It was Logan's legacy to Ben, and as such it held special meaning for him. The loss had been hard on Ben, of course. While he rarely spoke openly about it, she knew he blamed himself in some way. And he still had occasional nightmares, in which he called out sometimes for Keith and sometimes for Logan. When Beth shook him awake, the dream was always the same. He was floundering in the river, about to go under, when he saw Zeus coming toward him. In his dreams, though, he grabbed for the tail, only to find that he couldn't grasp it. He would reach and fail again and again, only to realize that Zeus no longer had a tail, and he would watch himself, as if from someplace else, flailing as he sank slowly under the water. When she reached the cemetery, Beth pulled into her usual spot. She carried 2 vases of flowers. First, as she always had when coming to this place, she went to the spot where Drake had been buried and took a moment to remember him before pulling a few weeds around the headstone and setting the flowers nearby. Then she went to the other grave.
She'd saved the larger floral arrangement for this one. It was his birthday, and she wanted to make sure he was remembered. Zeus wandered here and there, sniffing and exploring as he usually did. Ben trailed behind, as he had ever since Zeus had arrived. Ben had always loved the dog, but after Zeus had saved him in the river, it had become impossible to separate them. Zeus seemed to recognize what he had done, or at least that was the only way Beth could explain it, and in the dog's mind, they were now bound together. At night, he slept in the hallway outside of Ben's room. Stumbling to the bathroom in the middle of the night, Beth often spotted Zeus in his room, checking up on his beloved companion as he slept. Loss was complicated, and she and Ben both struggled with its after effects. She felt sometimes that their memories wreaked havoc with their grieving, for despite the heroism that marked their ordeal, their reminiscences were not always rosy. But when all was said and done, Keith Clayton would be remembered by her with unequivocal gratitude. She could never forget how he'd carried her when she fell that day, or that in the end, he died trying to save their son. That counted for something. That counted for a lot. And despite his other failings, that would always be how she chose to remember him. She hoped for Ben's sake that he would also come to remember him that way, without guilt, and with the certain knowledge of Keith's love for him, so elusive in his life to that point. As for her, Logan would be waiting when she got back home. He'd offered to go with her to the cemetery, but somehow she knew he hadn't really wanted to go. It was the weekend, and he preferred to spend the morning puttering around the grounds in solitude, repairing things and working on Ben's new treehouse in the backyard. Later, they planned to decorate the Christmas tree. She was getting used to his rhythms and his moods, recognizing the quiet signals that telegraphed who he was. Good and bad, strengths and faults, he was hers forever. As she pulled into the driveway, she spotted Logan coming down the steps from the house, and she waved. She was his forever, too, imperfect as she was. Take it or leave it, she thought. She was who she was. As Logan walked toward her, he smiled, as if reading the mind, and opened his arms. This has been a Hachette audio production of The Lucky One, written by Nicholas Sparks, read by John Bedford Lloyd, produced and directed by Robert Kessler, music by Rocco Cambereri and Robert Kessler, recorded at Kessler Media Productions, post-production by Kessler Media Productions, production supervised by Michelle McGonigal. The Lucky One is also available in print from Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette Book Group USA. Text copyright 2008 by Nicholas Sparks. Audio production copyright and published 2008 by Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Except as permitted under the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, no part of this production may be reproduced, distributed or transmitted in any form or by any means, or stored in a database or retrieval system without the prior written permission of the publisher. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales, is entirely coincidental.